So first, I want to send apologies from Terrace King, who was originally slated to come join us this afternoon. He was, at the time when he agreed to come and speak with us all, he was the acting director of the Office of Minority Health at CMS. And as often happens with the folks working in the federal government, he's been reassigned. So he was no longer in that role and unable to join us. But he definitely wanted to send his apologies to all of you and good wishes. So I would like to take a moment to introduce two wonderful, wonderful folks. I'm going to take just a moment to read their bios, and then we will jump into our session this afternoon. So closest to me is Jacqueline Scott, and she currently serves as the Senior Director for Strategic Integration for Healthcare Dynamic International. Ms. Scott holds appointments at the Harrison Institute for Public Law at the Georgetown University Law Center and Nyack College in Washington, D.C. She concentrates her health policy work in the areas of coverage, access, disparities, and vulnerable populations. While at Georgetown, she also served as the director for the National Center for Sustainable Health Outreach, or CSHO, as many of us know it as. And CSHO's mission is to support, promote, and advance the community health worker workforce. Ms. Scott has held past positions on the senior leadership team of the National Academy for Health Policy, NAHPE, for state health policy, and is a policy advisor in the governor's and lieutenant governor's offices in the state of Maryland, where she advised on issues ranging from community-based public health policy, women's health, juvenile justice reform, children, youth, and family matter-related matters. Ms. Scott serves as a consultant, lecturer, and trainer for numerous academic, state, local, private, and nonprofit organizations. The other thing that I'd like to share about Jackie is that she has been a wonderful mentor to CHWs who wish to learn more about policy and become more engaged. She's one of my personal mentors and longtime colleagues, and so please welcome Jacqueline Scott. And then next to Jackie, we have Dr. Alan Herman, and he is a South African native and experienced consultant in healthcare, public health, epidemiology. Most recently, Dr. Herman was the project director for Diabetes Self-Management Education Projects, funded by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, or CMS as we know it. Previously, Dr. Herman spent 8 years as the founding dean of the National School of Public Health of the Republic of South Africa, and was the architect and designer of the first e-learning master's degree program in public health in Africa. This program serves students in 26 countries across Africa. Additionally, Dr. Herman has extensive experience in developing large-scale research projects in the fields of health service research, maternal and child health, AIDS, cancer, mental health, and chronic disease. He has developed and led research projects in a number of states and the District of Columbia, in Scandinavia and Africa. He's written extensively on the role of race, social identity, economic status, on the health of populations, His work in HIV/AIDS included being the principal international advisor to the Honorable Ronald V. Dellums during his term as chairman of the U.S. Presidential Committee on HIV and AIDS. Dr. Herman has also advised the South African National Defense Force and helped to bring a substantial antiretroviral treatment program to the South African military. The treatment program was developed in partnership with the United States Department of Defense and the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases of the National Institute of Health. The other thing that I'd like to say about Dr. Herman is I had the honor of meeting him at a National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute meeting on CHWs last November. And that was the first opportunity I'd had to meet him. And some of the information he shared, as well as his own experience and stories around the CHW workforce, so moved so many of us that it was actually funny. Several of us tried to get to him immediately because we just knew that we had to have him here, that it was very important for him to come and participate in the CHW program at APHA. And so with that, Jackie Scott will lead us all. Actually, you know what? Is it easier to do it the other way around?
No.
Okay.
Perfect. Okay. Oh, that's okay. Thanks, Lisa Renee. Good afternoon, everyone. It is great to be here with you today and to be at this conference and just to see just how much interest and how much conversation is going on around supporting and advancing the community health worker workforce, and to see the journey that, how far we have come and seeing our section just really blossom. So this is very exciting. So today, I think that I'm starting off for you with the big picture, the broader picture. I want to sort of tell the story very quickly of the journey of how we've gotten to these critical conversations about the workforce and about the Affordable Care Act, and paint a broad picture about where things are in the states, and then turn it over to Dr. Herman to really kind of give you a very personal example of this work, how it's actually happening. And I think he's going to talk to you a little bit about a project that we had that I had the honor to work with him on some also too in the state of Mississippi. And then lots of questions and conversations, I hope, thereafter. So I'm going to jump in here, and hopefully I do this right. Press the right button. Yes, okay, so disclosures very quickly. I have no relationships to disclose. So first, I want to set the national context. As you'll see from this slide, this has truly been not something that we've woken up yesterday and said, we're here. It has been a lot of trench work, a lot of people working over the years on behalf of the community health worker workforce, a lot of us being led by community health worker leadership in this journey. So the highlights. For those of you who have been longtime APHAers, you may remember that there was recognition and policy resolutions passed in support of community health workers in both 2001 and 2009. In the midst of those two things, though, lots of things happened, and I think that it's important to see just the pivotal point that APHA and the group of folks who were involved in APHA were in starting the national conversation and spreading it. In 2002, many of you might have remembered the Institute of Medicine's report on unequal treatment that, you know, was huge in making a clear recommendation saying the words community health worker and health disparities together, and the importance of recommending the inclusion of community health workers there. In 2007, there was the HRSA Health Resources and Services Administration's National Workforce Study, a number of folks whom are in the room that were involved in that. We formed in 2008 out of the Georgetown Office of the Center for Sustainable Health Outreach, the American Association of Community Health Workers, and then quickly thereafter launched a collaborative effort to develop a guiding set of codes of ethics to govern and be a light post for community health workers, and that code was developed by and led by a national group of community health worker leaders. And then in 2009, the standard occupational classification for CHWs came out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and then the celebration of the 2010 ACA inclusion of community health workers very specifically in a number of places in which we will, which I will highlight. Oh, I went backwards, huh? There we go. Going forward is important. Okay, so that journey led us to where we are in this conversation. There are three very specific places that the Affordable Care Act mentions the inclusion of community health workers. First of all, as health professionals, the definition of community health workers as health professionals. Then you'll have a couple of areas that are very specific in the Affordable Care Act related to the CDC. They're related to the grants that promote the community health workforce and promote positive health behaviors. and these include chronic disease management and the not only just enrollment and outreach, but in chronic disease management, which is a place that I like to really highlight, that we are moving the needle literally on the express activities that community health workers are being recognized for being able to participate in and make a difference. The inclusion in the interdisciplinary training with clinicians by the area health education centers. And then I think just huge is that we had a community health worker appointed to the National Healthcare Workforce Commission, our own Lisa Renee, right here, was that community health worker and is that community health worker voice on that National Healthcare Workforce Commission. Why do I keep going back? Left side, okay. All right, so now you see that there was this trail of activity happening. Then there was, of course, a series of pieces in the Affordable Care Act. But then those things aren't happening in a vacuum either. There are a set of federal initiatives I want to just highlight, and there may be others that folks will be aware of in this room that we can continue to discuss. But just in terms of highlights, I have to say that the CDC has been a tremendous, tremendous partner in the advancement of community health workers and one of our, you know, fearless leaders always in the fight. I want to recognize Nell Brownstein from the CDC, the author of numerous papers and the advocate at the table for community health workers over the years, and a great colleague. So the CDC brief on addressing chronic disease through community health workers, critical policy brief that has come out at the same time as we're talking about how do we advance community health workers through the Affordable Care Act. The CDC e-learning series and policy site visits that we're selecting states, ongoing efforts. There is the HRSA and Department of Labor Registered Apprenticeship Program that began in 2010. Another significant partner. You saw that HRSA was involved very early on. We had champions in HRSA for community health workers and the workforce study that have just continued to be champions. So HRSA has been another significant champion. And then two very new but very big and pointed initiatives. The Office of Minority Health launched the National Plan for Action, which specifically called for the inclusion of community health workers as a workforce in the efforts that go not only in the area of health, but the Plan for Action looked across systems, and it engages health and housing, labor, a number of agencies, so that we begin to look at the workforce in a systematic way and be able to include them in a systematic way in all the efforts that those agencies touch. And then the establishment of the Department of Health and Human Services cross-agency Promotora CHW work group, to which some of you may already know about and also may be involved in. So, you take the national context and let's funnel it down to where we are and what's happening in the states. So today, many states are organizing, the CHWs in those states are organizing, some of them statewide, some of them in pockets of very large states, but they're organizing for empowerment, advocacy, recognition, a whole host of things. They are looking at the opportunities in the workforce that also include some level of a credential. And that conversation in many places is being led by and should be led by community health workers in that discussion. There's conversations around gaining recognition from legislators and state health officials, and employers, lots of education taking place there, lots of understanding of the definition and the work of community health workers, who they are in communities and who they represent. And then there are a number of states that all of us probably talk about a great deal, and there are many more, but the ones that we hear about a lot who are making significant progress as things move forward: Texas, Ohio, Minnesota, Massachusetts, New York, New Mexico, and others. And so specifically what I want to show you is that, so this is a map, and actually there are a couple places down in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana should be highlighted in this. Somehow my green didn't follow all the way through. The letters on my slide are green, but not the green. So what this represents is that there are at least 22 and probably more than that coalitions that are forming in these states. Again, not all are statewide. You know, there are Texas is a huge state. So we have organizations happening throughout the state. Similarly so, Mississippi. Similarly so, California. Places that are big that have to be able to have, you know, it's hard to get across the state, so people are getting together. New York, for example. But this is important because really the movement is happening in the states. And even in the states that are not highlighted, there are community health workers and community health representatives and others working hard every day in their communities. And it's our hope to begin to provide linkages and technical assistance to those who are already on the move to help those who are interested in organizing and self-identifying and building their capacity. But there is a lot of work happening right now in the states. So what does that state strategy look like? When we're talking about movement in the states, it's a combination of state innovation and these pieces of federal guidance that I highlighted, and conversations that are taking place that are really equaling the travel of the workforce development path. What do they look like? There are things that are happening that relate specifically to traditional state authorities. The questions around credentialing, certification, things like that that rest specifically with the states. Those things are taking place in states, and community health workers are at the table innovating how they need to think about implementing those kinds of things. Then there are, we've talked about the Affordable Care Act, specific things that are incentives for states that we'll talk about a little bit, that are encouragers for states to embrace community health workers. And if they are not currently encouragers, they should be, and they should be on your radar screen to go back home to make sure that they are encouragers. And then there are, of course, the pieces related to federal guidance that are around federal oversight and quality measures, quality assurance, to make sure that things are happening at the level and that we're getting the results that we hope to get out of the kinds of care that are provided to the people who need them. So what are some of those considerations? In terms of the community health worker training and education, and curricular development, those things that are taking place within states and are truly within the authority of the states. There are conversations happening now about the type of credential, whether or not it will be a required or voluntary credential, and the kinds of education, what is required, who will give that and provide that education, what's the scope of that education, how will it be given, who are the qualified trainers, what topics will be included in those trainings and in those credentialing programs. There are a few quick lessons here, all of which I'm sure those of you who are involved know that in-person trainings are much more helpful, beneficial to the workforce than online, but the reality is that because of some of the depth and breadth of these states and the kinds of delivery of programs, that some of them are taking place online. So what we have to ask ourselves is then how do we support the workforce to make sure that they can access those and that e-learning is able to be as fulfilling as possible, as particularly with as many universities that are moving towards e-learning opportunities. And, you know, at some point it would be wonderful to be able to have national e-learning collaboratives like the CDC is mirroring for us, so that, you know, no matter what coast you are in or wherever you are in the middle of the country, you can get access to a training program. Community settings, and as many as possible of those teaching opportunities going back to community health workers so that they are teaching their peers is so important to build into these programs. Related to that is, and staying within the scope of the state, is occupational regulation related directly to the type of credential. If the state and if the community health worker group chooses to go that way, what type of credential and who that credentialing authority should be. Some of the important lessons that people have made is that first and foremost, that planning and decision-making bodies must include community health workers, and not just one at the table. Community health workers, plural, which links to the second point, that a statewide organization has a significant, or even a local organization, has a significant role and being in that conversation and at the table. So if you're in a state that doesn't have a statewide organization, but you have a regional one, you have a group of people, your voice is important and you should be at the table. So you don't have to be statewide, but you need to be at the table and be active. And that we must include partners that really can support the adoption of the credentialing process. Who are the partners critical that should be at the table? Who are the ones that have the experience and the know-how, because perhaps they've been out there doing advocacy and outreach, before, but also they're the employers. They are the insurers. They're the people who, you need at the table to move it forward in a partnership way, because if community health workers are going to go through all of this and have to go through getting a credential, then we want a partner out there who recognizes that credential and is then willing to open the door for the jobs for that credential. Now, this is a piece that is in that bridge over to what the Affordable Care Act is now saying to states, and how this is turning out is, there's this delivery system reform. We're hearing this, right? Delivery system reform and payment system reform. Well, the goal of delivery system reform in this context is looking at ways that we want to integrate community health workers into the delivery system models that are being tested right now. Those models range from everything from accountable care organizations to medical homes, all of these things. And community health workers have opportunities, and they can play critical roles in the healthcare teams. We often get stopped because we're saying, okay, well, how do we do this? Where do we do this? We have one community health worker. What do we do? No, we're talking about systems. So we want to make sure that there are places at the table, because if you recognize right now that, these conversations are taking place and people are now forming accountable care organizations, your question should be, okay, where is the role for this profession right now? Because your accountable care organization, you're going to have to serve the communities that, that community health workers are currently serving. So why should they stay outside the circle? They need to be a part of, joined in the circle of that accountable care organization. Now, payment system reform is the other piece that's critical. You're looking at, how do we're having conversations today, sustainable funding sources. How do we find them? How do we create them? Where are the reimbursement opportunities and the mechanisms? And what is the process for securing funding? Let's move away from, while we all need them and we appreciate them and we want them, we want the grants, those are great, but we want FTEs. We want opportunities for community health workers to be embraced at the table along with every other provider within that part of the workforce that's out there in that accountable care organization or whatever it is, in the medical home, in the FQHC, all of those places. The challenge, I think, is that, payment reform is really, it is changing the face of how healthcare really will be delivered. I mean, delivery system reform and payment reform are being talked about sometimes in separate conversations, but they're so critically intertwined. And so when you're thinking about them, you have to think about, well, I can't deliver care without knowing how I'm going to pay for the care, right? So don't keep me out of one part of the conversation and look to put me in another part of the conversation. There's a lot of questions and conversation about reimbursement right now, but remember that we have to keep prevention on the table. And even though prevention sometimes, you know, seems like it's falling off with the debates on the Hill and what's going to be funded and when it's going to be funded. I mean, we have to stay and keep prevention on the table and to make sure that these payment systems value the care that's taking place on the prevention side, because we know how much community health workers do and can really make a difference there. So that is really important. The other piece of that is that, you know, I talked about FTEs. We want full-time positions. We want positions that have benefits. We want positions that have livable wages, those kinds of things. So those are important. And then something that's sort of sneaking up out there, and for those of you, I'm not a doctor. That's my disclaimer. I am not a physician. But those of you who are doctors and who are nurses who have to train on things like the ICD-10 and ICD-9 codes that relate to diagnosis and billing and services provided. Those things are changing now too. So when you're at the table with your colleagues and you're talking about your goal of including a community health worker, make sure you keep in mind, okay, are we saying that this code can now be delivered by this professional? Because then that code is going to translate to what's being paid for and who can deliver it. So, I mean, there's just so many layers. And so that's why I say there's room for all of us. Those of us who are the policy folks, those of us who are, you know, the scientists, those of us who are delivering the care, everybody around this effort to be at the table. And then, of course, I have there, you know, cost and potential cost savings, which we know our research papers are now, you know, showing us, and then the questions and the conversations around bundling services and payments. Then finally, there is quality assurance. We know that there's a big push on quality measures right now. So, you know, tracking effectiveness, accountability, and comparability. We have suffered in this field of advancing community health worker practice and professions all the time by people saying to us, what's the evidence? What's the evidence? What's the evidence? And so now we're writing about the evidence, and we know the evidence, and we have it out there. And so we have to continue that. There are roles for those who are researchers. There are roles for us, those who are evaluators, to be partners in this, because we do continuously have to make the case. Even though we know in our hearts of hearts, and we see the results in our communities every day. At the other end of the spectrum, when you have states and federal governments and providers and employers and insurers that have to count numbers and that have to decrease their cost and are looking for returns on investments, we have to be able to use those terms, be empowered by those terms and not afraid of them, and be at the table to have that conversation. And then how do you do all this? You do all this through what we know we're doing here in this room, stakeholder collaboration. You know, we have to have everybody at the table, community health workers first and foremost, employers, other professionals, medical providers. Partnering ensures that there is true awareness and participation from everybody. We have to continue to educate one another, and then meeting with CHW associations early on is critical. You know, if you have this idea about what you want to do in your clinic or in your practice or in your foundation, in your organization, in your agency, go to your community health workers, go to the leadership, go to the association early on, engage them. They can help you solve the problem. I just have up here my last few minutes, just a couple of things I want to highlight. I won't read all these strategies for sustainability we can talk about during our Q&A, but building consensus around core competencies is really one that is very important. Community health workers have to be at the table. They have to lead this discussion. What are the core competencies, and then how do you move those into states and to make it a comprehensive state policy? Seek opportunities for community health workers in the emerging models. We talked about that. Support community health worker associations and their leadership development. Anything that you can do in your states, in your communities, in your regions to support the community health workers. If you support them, their workforce, and their leadership development, they will be able to just make so many strides on behalf of their own workforce, but they need the support. And that support is not always financial necessarily, although that money helps. That's important. But, you know, understanding what they need to do their jobs, understanding the importance of them being able to have the time off to go advocate, understanding to have the kinds of work-life balances that we all strive for, given the stressors of their work and the accommodations that, you know, they need to successfully do their job. And then just highlighting here, identifying champions in all sectors. I can't say it enough. It's just not one sector. It is important that we build champions and identify them from all sectors. Policy development and advocacy is sometimes the way that you have to start with, but it's not always. You don't always have to jump into legislation and regulation. You can do some things without it, but you should know that it's a tool that's there. And I did talk about it. Document, document, document as much as we can and publish. And community health workers, publish. And that's a key support that those of us who are not community health workers can give to community health workers. Give them the venue to be the authors, to be the presenters, to have the exposure, because that's where you really have the power in the words directly from the community health workers. I'd like to just give a special thanks, and I know Gail's not in the room yet, she's doing two things at once, but she really, Gail Hirsch was a great help to me in talking through and putting through this presentation for me, so I wanted to give her a special thanks, and then you all have my contact information up here, and I do have cards, and I look forward to the conversation after Dr. Herman. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. I just want to ask folks, I know that many of you may have questions right now, but what we're going to do is just ask you to hold your questions for now, and then when Dr. Herman is done with his presentation to you all, then we'll open up and have a large chunk of time for discussion, question, and answers. Thank you. Dr. Herman?
Well, I want to start by saying that I am a community health worker. And
yay.
I've been involved in community health work for... You may be surprised, for almost 47 years. Why not? When I was 10 years old, my mother took me on her clinical rounds as a community health worker. She was a community health nurse, but she had risen up as a nursing assistant and became a nurse who worked in the community. I speak 5 languages on a good day. My mother spoke 13, and she learned her 13th language to communicate with people who could not speak English or any one of the other 11 languages that she knew. She learned how to speak Hindi, because one of the communities that she worked with was a group of immigrant Indian women. And I remember my first outing with my mother, carrying a little black bag, starched white uniform, little cap with the gray cape, going from home to home, and the way she engaged each and every single one of those individuals. About 7 years later, I went to medical school, and I think that sort of stuck in the back of my head. I graduated from medical school, and I went to work in what is a community health center with an infant mortality rate in the community of almost 20%, with real serious problems. This was South Africa pre-apartheid, where black people had real serious health problems. And fortunately, my boss at the time was one of the leading advocates of community health workers and community health work. And she was a white Afrikaner woman, but that wasn't a barrier. So I was able to hire community health workers and change the infant mortality of a community from 200 per thousand to about maybe 15 per thousand. We replicated that activity in Washington, D.C. many years later, and I think I learned my lesson from both my mother and from this work that I did with this remarkable woman who was an advocate for community health work. So I come from a tradition where community health work is a foundational activity within the healthcare system and not an add-on. It's not an afterthought. It's not some kind of confused category of healthcare worker that has no value. And I call myself a community health worker. I have two doctorates, and so what does that mean? Doesn't really mean anything if I cannot make the community's health better. All it is would be an activity where I feel very good about myself and have no impact on communities. And Jackie and I started working together in Mississippi, where people say things about the community that are mostly untrue and mostly ahistorical and have no clue about the folk down there. Partly because when you speak to Mississippians, especially rural Mississippians, it's pretty hard to understand them. They speak a kind of English that's odd. And with my accent, communication was sometimes difficult. One thing my mother taught me was to listen, and listen actively and carefully. And so we did lots of listening in Mississippi, lots and lots of listening. But there was a very interesting story in Mississippi that community health work is almost 80 years old. The community health nurse was a white woman working in white communities in the teens, 20s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s, and 60s in Mississippi. The community health worker was a version of a village midwife that was trained by the health department to provide primary care within communities for black folk. Those of you who remember your history, the great flood of 1922 in Yazoo City, where people had to ferry help across the great Mississippi in boats, flat-bottom boats, and community health workers went to black communities in these boats to look after newborn children. So the idea of a community health worker in Mississippi is not a new one. So when we started talking to the health department, we reminded them that they had trained the first group of community health workers in the 20s, and that in part they needed to create a new kind of idea for community health work that included both people who have formal health professional training and other folk who have access to the community. So I'll get back to the Mississippi story in a minute. One of the things that bothers me about the idea of community health workers is that they tend, or they have tended in the United States, to be seen as separate. And they have tended to be seen as people coming from communities that don't have formal mechanisms of moving through the healthcare system. So those are the two things that bothered me when I got to Mississippi. Now, people in this room don't have that problem, but trust me, when you go to the University Medical Center in Mississippi, the great big University Medical Center that is the third largest employer in the state of Mississippi. I mean, the UMC is the third largest employer. Just think about it. Healthcare, hospital care, is the third largest employer in a state after the Nissan factory and some fishing or coastal, and actually being overtaken now by gambling. So it's Nissan, gambling, and health. Those are the employers. And you talk to the folk in the medical school and the nursing school, they don't really have a clue as to how to manage bringing people from poor communities into the healthcare system as professionals. They say things like, oh, they're not qualified. Now, there are those of us in this room who've been told that from the time we're 10 years old. Oh, you're not qualified. I mean, I still get told that I'm not qualified, which is a source of great humor to me. I'm not qualified, so who is? Do I have to walk on water to be qualified? So I think that issue is a primary barrier, that young men and women who live in poor communities are seen as not qualified or not qualifiable. So when you train them as a community health worker, you're training a throwaway person. Once the project is over, you let them go. You have no mechanism to integrate them. You're not concerned about integration because your only concern is making this project work. So that's one problem that I saw as really a huge problem. The second problem I saw as being a huge problem is that people did not take risks in identifying smart folk and training them and giving them pathways. They didn't take risks. They found almost the person who could be a lowest common denominator, and they trained those folk because they really didn't want to be bothered with somebody who had ambition. So I met this remarkable physician in Mississippi, Dr. Aaron Shirley, who is probably one of the most remarkable men I've ever met. During the civil rights struggles in Mississippi in the 60s, he was the first person to do his residency at UMC, Ole Miss, first person of color. And I asked him one day, so how did you manage to practice as a pediatrician and be an activist and live in Mississippi? Because we all get told about these stories about people who came from the north and did these remarkable things in Mississippi. I want to know how a black Mississippian managed this problem, where the KKK's headquarters was in Canton, and he lived just outside Canton, Mississippi. He said, well, you know, I'm not one of those pacifist Negroes. I had my gun, and I would inform the sheriff that if they came visiting, and if he sent any white police officers, they may not come back. So Aaron is a person who is extraordinarily brave and still challenges the status quo. So the two of us got together and said, so how do we manage and build a community health worker task force for this project that we're doing on diabetes self-management education? And he said, first of all, we need to educate them. We need to give them a pathway to a health education if they wanted. We need to make sure that a community health worker can become a doctor if she or he so wishes. And we need to build this ladder. So we went to Jackson State University, and they have a School of Public Health, and we said to them, can you commit to a barter system where if we train these people and they come to you with our certificate, you can give them access to a master's degree in public health? And these were young women who were getting aid for family with dependent children. One of the young women was the most remarkable young woman, was homeless for about 4 or 5 years, has 2 children, and is now in nursing school. Started off as a community health worker because she wanted to become a nurse, not because she didn't think community health work was beneath her, but she wanted to use this as a pathway. And so some of the other people want to become bankers and lawyers and other things, and this is a way to get into a system. So the next step was to get UMC to accept some of these people in their nursing and medical school programs. Because one thing that I heard more than once from the vice chancellor and dean of the medical school at UMC was, there are not enough qualified black people. And that's a fairly common statement. And I said to the dean one day, so why don't you qualify them? And he said, well, it's difficult. I said, well, I went back to South Africa, started a school of public health, and qualified people to have an MPH. So I built a bridge between where they were and where they wanted to be. And that bridge was an academic bridge, and you an academic institution. It ought not to be that hard for you to build a bridge between where people are and where they want to be. And so you will qualify your own people. And he said, well, it's hard. I said, it's not. I mean, I worked with people who were much less qualified than many of the people who come from your institutions of higher learning, and you can build this bridge, and it would make you a good person in the community. And that's the struggle at the moment in Mississippi, to build this bridge between Jackson State University and the medical school, and Jackson State University and the nursing school. And that's not because community health work is unimportant. Community health work is important. I've done it for most of my professional career. I do epidemiology. I write complicated programs, I understand all sorts of interesting things, but I know in my heart of hearts that if I do not do community health work, I cannot do the kind of project that I want to do. And we have had remarkable success in complex projects. The most recent one, just as an aside, I was the principal investigator for a NIMH study, a national mental health study, where we had to interview people on their mental health status, and the interview length was 4.5 hours. Usually people who do this kind of work tell you about incentives. I said, we don't need incentives. What we need are good people from the community who understand the community, who can engage, and we will have a good response. And we had back and forth fights with people from fancy universities with names like Harvard and so on. And I said, community health work is at the heart of a successful program in diverse and poor communities. We did a study with 6 languages, and our response rate was 92% for a population of a study size of 4,500 people. And when I showed this response rate, people didn't believe it. And the only reason we were that successful is that I found community health workers, trained them in interviewing techniques, and sent them out and said, I don't care how you do it, but talk to your people and interview them. And they felt good about it because we gave them a ladder. I also was the dean of a faculty, so I could do other things like say, if you do this and you want to come do an MPH, you'll get preferential treatment. And I didn't have to ask a board, a committee, or anything. I just made a fiat decision as dean. This was my decision. The fortunate part of it was that we had a remarkable study and people are still publishing from this project. So I understand that I can do statistical analysis, but if I don't do community analysis and work with ordinary folk in a community, there's no ways I can do this kind of work. So as a scientist, I rely on community health work. As a physician in South Africa working in a community health center, I relied on community health workers. Because when a mother came in, and she was 16 years old, and this was her third pregnancy, and she had syphilis. Now, how am I going to solve that problem on my own? I'm not smart enough. I'm not connected enough. I'm not sensitive enough to be able to talk to a young woman whose life basically has been thrown in the toilet by a system of racial oppression and by a system of a patriarchy that used her up. So the only people that could help me was sending out community health workers into the community to look after young women like that. And then they would come back and we'd think about a plan of action and then go back again to help them. The first time I actually examined a young woman in my family planning clinic that I was running, who actually was both positive for syphilis and gonorrhea, and she was 12 years old, I wanted to run out of that examining room screaming and find another job that wasn't so emotionally taxing. And the only way you could do that is by working with people from the community who understood the context. They may not be able to explain the context. That's the whole point. Community health workers often can't explain why the context matters, but they know the context matters and they have a sense of how to take this context and translate it into action. And you wander around as a professional, quote unquote, with all these skills, and you couldn't translate a minor skill into action in poor communities. But the problem we face is that a lot of people who do community health work or train community health workers or participate have never actually done the work. So they don't know the translational skills of the community health worker, so they give them simple jobs because they think they're not smart enough. They give them jobs that are algorithmic, that you can give a monkey to do because there's a simple algorithm to follow. They don't give them jobs that engage their true understanding, intelligence, and genius about the community. That's the kind of job they give community health workers. And when they don't work, they blame the community health worker. So I've seen far too many programs like this. And part of this new movement in community health work, led by folk like this, is in fact changing the paradigm that says the community health worker has a set of intelligences that are quite remarkable. And if you engage those intelligences, you will change the health and the healthcare of a people. So, I want to come to another point that really bugs me. I mean, seriously bugs me. It annoys me. It infuriates me. It makes me see red. Is this whole notion of evidence-based, this or that or the other. Now, I was there at the beginning of evidence-based work. The person who actually started this work many, many years ago started the work in maternal and child health. And our big argument at the time was, well, randomized trials are fine, but there's community information that is good evidence. So how do you, in fact, take this information and translate it into numbers and make it speak to the issues of the day? You ask most people, and some of us have been doing this for many years, like my friend Robert back there, on disparities and gaps between blacks and whites. There are no real studies that give you evidence that one thing or another works. We spent our life, 20 years or more, trying to understand what racism does to health. or what poverty does to health. We've never actually had an intervention that works because it's too difficult. But we spend our lifetime studying the problem to death. Now, the reason why this annoys me is I grew up in a slum where we had no internal electricity or water or any of those things. We had outside toilets, all the sort of negatives that you can think of in a slum, under a system of oppression that considered me to be half human. That's where I grew up. So when people come to me and suggest that we should study a problem when the action is to do something about it, it infuriates me. It seriously does. It should infuriate all of us. The point is that a community health worker is at the center between a clinical system and a community system. And that individual, we can't start doing interventions without having evidence, because if we are smart enough and design interventions that places the community health worker in the middle, then we may actually have some success. A community health worker as a member of a team, but a key member of the team, a person that does both translational activities between the community and the provider and back again, and the person who actually is smart enough to know what action would work in a particular context. And that's important. And until we start doing projects like that and research projects like that and build accountable care organizations that do that, then we will not reduce the gap between blacks and whites. We won't. I don't care how smart you think you are. If you look at infant mortality in the District of Columbia since 1890, the gap between blacks and whites in 1890 was about 1.5. In fact, a relative gap of 50%. The gap between blacks and whites today in the District of Columbia is 100%. The gap has increased. Infant mortality has dropped for both, but it's dropped more rapidly for whites than for blacks. In fact, since 1950, infant mortality rates have dropped very rapidly for whites. And what seems to be going on is that there's some action of translating healthcare and access for people in poor communities like Southeast DC. So I'm not interested in evidence until people start doing interventions. And intelligent interventions that use the community health worker and their intelligence and genius to make things, to change things. And that's my other concern. And I get into lots of trouble because I say things like this, because it's not politic to say things like this. It's not appropriate. You make people uncomfortable. But I like making people uncomfortable about issues like this, because the gaps in health and healthcare for the poorest among us, and this doesn't matter whether it's black people who are poor, white people who are poor people. I worked in Western Tennessee, where most of the people that were poor were working with white folk. Rural white people were poor, no access to health care. They have the same sorts of problems. And we used community health workers there with great success. We connected them to the health care system. And we were able to get them to change their behavior within that connected system, because it wasn't blaming them for the reasons of their own ill health, but finding ways to bring them into the healthcare system. So I want to end off by going back to my childhood. I mean, my mother was a really remarkable woman, and I lost her when I was too young. Smart, capable, probably I get a lot of what are my intellectual skills from her. My father would disagree, but that's his problem. That's his problem. And she started life out having finished 10 years of education. So she, what would be the 10th grade. And because it was at an age where apartheid had just started and lots of young black women could not go to the next level of education, she left and got a job as a nurse's aide. And when the year she died, my mother was a senior in the United States. She would have been a professor of nursing education in one of the major institutions. And her pathway started off as a community health worker. That's where she started. She didn't start with a fancy degree. And people get confused because I speak the way I do, that they think that I came from a family where people had all sorts of access. The access I had was my mother, who made sure that I actually did things to make the world a better place. So I want to sort of finish with that and argue that the community health worker, we will give that individual a title and a job description and a full-time equivalent position, but in those communities where they are most necessary, we need to use them to enlarge the health workforce and have more doctors that look like the community, more nurses that look like the community, more health policy experts that look like the community, so they can speak to the issues that affect them, and we then don't have to speak for them. And one of the great things working in Mississippi was keeping quiet when somebody in the community spoke about an issue and only speaking to clarify and making sure that that clarification doesn't place upon the community member something they didn't want to say. Because there's a great intelligence in these communities that have survived some of the worst oppression. I mean, do you actually think that people who've lived in Mississippi, who've survived the kind of oppression that most folk have, don't have an intelligence about the world? That's stupid. The fact you don't understand them is your problem, not theirs. They've suffered and they've had great and hard lives to live. And if you go to the Delta in Mississippi and look at some of the farmers that have had a hardscrabble existence and their parents before them and grandparents before them, you will understand just how much they know about the world. And you will use that knowledge to change the way their healthcare system is provided for them. So for me, a community health worker is the best kind of worker you ought to have. You should pick the right ones in the community that you work with, and you should listen to what they have to say. And if you don't, you'll have a crappy program. Simple as that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Herman, and thank you also to Jackie. We've got some time now. We purposely wanted to make sure that we had some time for discussion and question and answer, so please in the back. And if you would identify yourself, that would be helpful.
Lisa, hi. My name is Susan Susan. I'm from Dallas, Arizona. And both of you kind of enhanced the sense of conflict that I feel around this whole issue. And I'm very glad that you did, in the sense that the dynamic of recognizing CHWs and integrating them into the system, but also not losing the passion and the heart of the indigenous knowledge that is their intuitive leadership that makes them so special. And so it's a very complex combination. I want to find the sweet spot for that, but I just see a lot of challenges on both sides, just with the individuals I work with in my own community and making that transition, not losing where we came from and protecting what's really important. Thank you. We can talk about that.
Well, I think one of the problems we face in identifying and using the intelligence of the community is that we have a formalized system of identifying what intelligence actually means. And part of what I've done in Mississippi, what I'm trying to do is to actually create a narrative that includes the people that I'm working with and try and tell their story with their help. And once you have that narrative, you actually have as much of the community knowledge as you can. My grandfather was a traditional healer in South Africa. And so I grew up in a family where traditional knowledge was respected because you had to respect your grandfather. So, and one of the things that I bring from Africa is the power of narrative. And I think sometimes we make things too formal. If you sit down and have a conversation with a community leader and you write down their story, in that story is the intelligence of that community. And if you gather many stories together, you actually have you don't lose that. If you bring your own perception to the party and you don't listen, you actually will lose all of that information. And it's actually quite quick when you lose it. You think you have it and you've lost it. The second part of it is you have to ask the folk who come in as community health workers what it is that what are their wishes and dreams? What do they want to be in life? And you have to, in fact,
respect that and make that attempt to make that happen for them. And sometimes it means taking on large, powerful structures, but if you show that you're doing it, they will be much better for you, even if you don't succeed. So those are the two things. If you bring people in, you really have to listen to what they want and why they came to you. And secondly, you actually have to take down as much as you can, and we have lots of modern techniques to be able to gather narratives, and that's where the knowledge lies. It doesn't lie someplace else.
I guess I wanted to ask you to tell me about the conflict. What is it that's conflicting you? Is it that, I'm stopping, what is it that's conflicting you?
Well, some of the individuals that are attracted to prediction, for example, are not fully focused on the community. Sometimes it's just more focused on getting into the health system or their career. We have some community health workers that have been working with us for a very long time, monolingual Spanish. They don't have an interest in moving away from community work into a more integrated care model in the clinical setting, for example. And I fear that they can get left behind professionally and in terms of salary and things if they don't make that transition. I don't want it to be an either or. I want to conserve having community health workers involved in lots of different parts of the health sector, but definitely not lose their ability to work outside of the clinic setting, in the community, and do a lot of the things that can't happen within a healthcare setting. And have them be fairly compensated. I don't want them to lose ground. Because what I see happening in the community health center world a little bit anyway is the idea, we'll get DHWs to become a part of the healthcare team, and staff are coming in new and they're starting at a higher rate than someone that's worked there for 10, 20 years as a CHW. That's where some of my conflict lies. Does that help?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I thought that was sort of where you were going, but I wanted Jim to be able to hear you think.
Thank you.
So I'm going to add to what you just said. I am a CHW. I've been a CHW for 20 years. I want to remain a CHW. And there are many CHWs across the country that want to remain CHWs. But there are others who would like to do other things. So I think you're right. We've got, within our own workforce, we have some folks who would like to do other things, and that's great and wonderful and fine. But I think by the same vein, we have to make sure that we're supporting those of us that want to remain CHWs. We want to be paid equitably. We want that respect when we're working with other professionals in healthcare and human services. And as we, as collectively as a workforce, that's something that we have to continue to say. It's something that we have to continue to recognize and that we have to work towards. And so that those of us that want to remain CHWs have the same respect as those in the workforce who wish to go on and do other things. And I think those who wish to go on and do other things bring strengths, as Dr. Herman just said, that many other folks don't bring to those various other healthcare and human service professionals.
I think the hardest thing about that is that everybody is facing that same thing, and there's truly not an answer to it. I think what you have to do is face that there will be tough choices. And just as any of us as individuals have to make tough choices, the same, so we feel like we have to answer every question because someone asks it of us. We are asked, and I say we, in this journey, we are asked to answer questions sometimes that are so unfair. To what extent do you expect this workforce to carry a burden that no other workforce has? So I use myself as a prime example, and I always say, those of you who hear me talk, law school was my choice. I went my educational career ladder and got my degree because I chose to, then it's mine. I do with it and make my career and personal choices where I'd like them to be. And the best thing we can do is open up the door wide and allow for every piece of that spectrum to make that choice where they want to be, and to try our best to undergird
and ensure that there's no abuses in the system as much as we can, and that people understand the tools of those choices and the consequences of their choices and the pros and cons of all those choices, but that they themselves as a workforce make them. But that we don't feel like we are pigeonholed into coming up with the perfect answer, because these are all problems that we're going to face, you know. And so there will be, I tell people automatically, in the credentialing discussion, you will leave some people behind. The question is, are you leaving them behind because you're giving them the choice to decide whether or not they want to get on the bus or not, or are you closing the door on them in the bus with no choice at all? And so as much as possible, we leave the choice. That builds the empowerment of the workforce to make the decisions and define who they are and themselves.
I'm sorry, did you have a follow-up?
I just said thank you to all of you.
Sorry, John.
Thank you. My name is Edgar Marcus. I am the executive director of the Community Health Worker Network of NYC, which is an independent professional association. We exist to support the CHW workforce. I thank you, Lisa Renee, for your comments and thank you too. It is wonderful and a wonderful secondary outcome if CHW become nurses and bring some humanity to that practice, and the same is true for doctors, but that is not why we exist. Our existence is to support the CHW workforce. And so I want to second our experience is common in that a large population of our membership wants to be CHW. That is their passion, that is their purpose. And we must defend that. I also want to say that although healthcare is certainly presents many opportunities right now in the reformation of our system, it is dominating the narrative. And as CHW leaders and CHWs ourselves, we need to always remind people that our scope of practice extends outside of the healthcare system, and that many, many, many of our practitioners work in systems that are health, but that are not recognized as health elements by the medical culture. And so our members who work in violence prevention and in hunger and food insecurity and in family reunification, these are issues that are essential to health. And in fact, are issues that are presenting themselves in the doctor's office, but the doctor has no answer. And so I think it's important to recognize that our workforce is diverse. It includes members that work outside of the healthcare system, and particularly in this dominant Medicaid redesign climate, we must always reiterate that. I want to lastly highlight and ask you in particular to mention our healthcare system does not work. It is fragmented, it is dysfunctional, and it is inaccessible as fragmented as it is currently. I get a sense that the CHW role in bringing the community's voice to systems and helping those systems change, I think this has to do with the piece that Jeff. I get a sense that, you know, our system is a Goliath. It's a dysfunctional, fragmented Goliath. And we're asking little David to defeat it and to solve it. And that's unfair. And so as much as CHWs, I think, play a critical and vital role in informing systems to become more appropriate, that's a monumental task. And one that I believe that you need to be respected.
Sergio, I think you've hit it on the head. I think healthcare reform and payment reform offer us as a workforce some unique opportunities that we don't want to miss, because we don't want to miss the boat, but that's not the end all and be all, the workforce. You know, Jackie said that yes, I was appointed to this commission, but I also want to share with folks that I have never in my career, my 20-year career, worked for a health system or a community health center, ever. I always worked in other pockets of health, holistic health, that help communities to be healthy. And you're right. So I am personally always conscious of that. And I would hope that all of you in the room, as you move forward and are having conversations with people about CHWs and how to integrate us into this particular piece of health, that you don't forget the other pieces that affect people's health in communities. So thank you, Sergio.
Sergio, I just wanted to respond to one of your issues. The challenge in credentialing and creating curricula
is to actually create a proper community outlook curriculum that actually extends from entry to doctoral level. And if you're not going to do that, then you won't get the full professionalization in the long term. And this is a challenge that very few institutions want to pick up. And when I went back to South Africa, one of the key problems we had was that AIDS was swallowing the healthcare system. 20% of South Africans were HIV positive. So we created two programs. One was a certificate program that was considered to be a 50% of a master's program, and anybody could enter that from communities. So any community health worker could enter the program. And I allowed them in, and we would evaluate them based upon their experiential learning. And so that was the doorway I created. The second thing was we created a community-oriented primary care master's degree. So you could actually go from 1 year in a program that was a certificate program to 2 years as a master's and then onto a doctorate, where you actually did community health work. It wasn't something else masquerading as community health work. And I think the true challenge in the United States is, can you create a credentialing system that allows institutions to build a full academic and rigorous academic program in community health work? Because community health work is hard. And at your entry level, you don't have the skills that a 20-year person has. And so can you use experiential learning to bring people into a learning environment and give them more skills, and they can go back and work wherever they want? But the problem is that we don't want to do this because we see the community health work as an add-on and not as an infrastructure builder. And that's my dilemma, that the add-on doesn't work, infrastructure works, but you have to give an educational system. Any universities in New York are doing community health work at an advanced level training, and if not, they should be.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. I have to disagree with you. Community health workers have a unique scope of practice, and I think all of us who advocate have to really become familiar with that vocabulary. Many people do community health work, but community health workers do a sort of unique scope of practice. And what we need to do is to recognize that scope of practice for its own worth and its own validity. Not that it requires an academic credential, but that it in and of itself has a value. And that value might not be recognized in academic norms and values, but in community, it has its own purpose and its own value. And it does not depend on community. It depends on values that exist in community. And so
I think we agree with each other.
Oh, well, I hope so.
So, Sergio, I'm going to ask that you move on, but please, I think it's really important that we continue these discussions collectively. Yes.
Hi. I'm Yvonne Rivera. I'm from D.C. I work in public health research as a qualitative and conducting also community surveys. I also had the privilege of training community health workers. So thinking, how do I put this together? So the issue is to train community health workers to become interviewers during conducting community surveys with Latino communities. So we worked on a project for 5 years. We went into very violent crime, neighborhoods that only community health workers, people that look like us, could really go and knock on the doors. Here I am. I'm not ICE, I'm not immigration. And so it was very successful. The challenge for me is to really convince my client. I do have some favorite clients that share my vision, that truly believe in training community health workers and making them a part of a project to be successful, either research, but that's the challenge for me, is to convince PIs that I can really train community health workers as research interviewers and as a very valuable element to implementing
the program. So, well, the NIH in community research demands that you have a community advisory board. And through that community advisory board, every single NIH project that's in a community must have some community participation. What usually happens is that people do the least they possibly can. what needs to happen is that the community advisory board ought to push them to do as much as they can, which includes bringing community members into the research, into research. And when we first started community advisory boards in the early 90s, it was people resisted it because it was saying that community had oversight over science. That wasn't acceptable. So I think that there are now mechanisms, and in the ethics area, mechanisms to make sure that if you're going to do a community project, you need to have community participation. And any member of the community can challenge a project in the community for lack of community participation. And that took a long time for that to happen. As many people at NIH or CDC or other grants know that they have to deal with it, but the usual thing they do is they hope that nobody checks on that. And partly it's the community that needs to be proactive, because a lot of scientists who are interested in this pushed for this to happen. So if you know of a project in your community where you don't have community health workers, you need to challenge them. You need to go to their meetings and say, where are your community health workers? And that's a challenge that I think is part of the advocacy role that community health workers ought to take on. Because science in the community and translational science cannot be done without community health workers. So you need to make sure that people don't just hire anybody, and hire people who have the skill set for community interaction and so on.
I'm going to go on the back, way back, and then I'll work my way up to the front.
Well, that's a follow-up on that. I think the greater challenge is not, can you convince researchers to take on community health workers as interviews? I mean, that's the basic step. I know many projects that have community health workers on them, and that their one role is the intervention. And that's such a loss in terms of that project. There's one particular project that I know right now where the community health workers are sitting there doing nothing, because they can't get anyone in the project. And so they keep saying, gosh, what are we going to do? I'm like, you? You can't get anyone in your project because there's something wrong with how you're doing your recruitment, and the community health workers could fix that in a minute. And then have them design the intervention in a way that's going to be appropriate, not just ask the questions that you thought up in a closet somewhere. So that's just such the, and the argument should be not that you should train us to be your interviewer, you should train us to be your co-investigator and to be involved in all levels, and this will not compromise your science. This will enhance your science. And there's plenty of language around that if you need to make this research model that would allow you to do that. But it's a little tricky because some people are going to argue that you must enhance the science. But if you use the right language, then you can perfectly defend it and you'll get extra support.
Just to respond, one of my most difficult research questions was, how do we figure out information about people who tortured other people? Because in South Africa, there's a lot of torture. So we wanted to interview people who were torturers. We wanted to figure out, why did you do this? And do you have any mental health effects from torturing other people? And the people were very fast. That's a good question. Okay, you know who answered the question first? Community health workers. Because they lived in the communities where torture took place and where torturers lived. So they were able to tell us how to approach these people. And we actually had we have the largest group of torturers that would have ever been studied, about 70 people who tortured other people. And so we know what their mental health consequences are, because we needed to know this so that we could answer the question, does the torture suffer the same consequences as the tortured? And the answer to that is yes. But we didn't know how to ask that question. Literally, our interview schedule, we didn't know how to ask the question. And so you're right, you actually have to bring community health workers in that help you ask a question on a community issue that's so sensitive that you will make a mistake if you ask it right up front. So I agree with you.
Can I just piggyback off
of Yes, please.
I am a community health worker from San Francisco, and I'm actually the first female community health worker in the nation working with reentry. I've been incarcerated, and I was hired also by Yale in New Haven to be trained to be a research studier for HIV with the food stamp. So they did a thing where they hired trained by a professional.
And I would like to applaud you on your accomplishments. I think that's amazing. Is it a fault?
You will be that professional doing that training.
Yes, please.
We're a certified institution, and to piggyback on, I have a separate question, but to piggyback on the research, we train our promotoras to be institutional review board. We do a training as well, and they get a certification. It's an all-day training, and this is how we got buy-in from the researchers to accept them as
I like that.
And that's the IRB process, yeah, so that's helped a lot. And we are one of the HRSA grantees right now for patient navigation. And so we have this great model that we have been researching for the last 3 years now. And we're also opening up the door for transitional care model, working with hospitals, and we're actually contracting. The problem I'm running into is equitable pay. Because we pay our community health workers between $27,000 to $35,000 a year. And for the state, when you add on the fringe benefits, that's up to $42,000 to $45,000 a year. And so now that we're trying to negotiate a contract with the hospitals, you know, that's as much as an LVN makes, a licensed vocational nurse in Texas. And so that we're getting some pushback on it. But I was wondering, since you guys are on the forefront of this movement, if y'all have any idea what equitable pay looks like.
The short answer to that, and the honest answer is no. Because there's tremendous variation from state to state, locality to locality, and honestly, on job description to job description. But I think the larger case is that if you looked at the number and level of people that hospitals employ, the reality is that this position is not going to break the bank.
Yeah.
That's the first place they're going to take you. Like, how much, you know, is this going to cost me? And even at that $45,000 loaded rate, you're still, on the scope of all the people that they employ to do the things that they do, including looking for, you know, billing overages and uncompensated care and all those kinds of things. I mean, I think what you probably should do is, I mean, and this is for everybody, I mean, this is as much education that you can do around hospital administration, just sort of how hospitals work, and in this new system, how they will be paid for the things that they have to decrease, and really talk about what that savings, that one $45,000 investment in terms of inappropriate readmissions and all the other things that you know that you're going to be doing on the front line to make the case, because as much of it is just knowing the language when you're at the table. So that they know that you know what you're talking about.
And what we're working on is that, you know, how they're being penalized because of the Medicare readmission. Right now, I think it's 2%, and then it's going to go up 4 or 5 years. And so we're trying to come up with some numbers as far as for readmission for how many people would it take to pay for one patient? How many readmissions?
In the Mississippi Project, and I'm going to be presenting at the session just after this, some of the cost-benefit issues. We had about 150 Medicare people who we had enough data from the Medicare system to look at the cost. In some cases, a 90% reduction in cost from about $100,000 to about $2,000 in the cost before and after people had a diabetes self-management education program that was managed by nurse educators and community health worker educators. So you have huge reductions in the cost of chronic care. emergency room department admissions reduced by 70%. We're not talking about small reductions here. This is huge impact. And one of the things you do is when you go and talk to the hospital administrator, you need to have these data with you. And most hospital administrators have real problems, especially with something like diabetes. I talked to the guy who ran the Jackson Medical Center in Jackson, Tennessee, not Jackson, Mississippi, and used these kinds of data to convince him that this was something that he had to take on, because if he didn't, in about 20 years' time, his hospital will be overrun by people who are coming over and over again because the diabetes rates are so high in that area. So we really have to start doing cost-benefit work to show the community health workers are actually the most cost-efficient way to reduce chronic disease costs. I mean, they really are. I don't know how doctors and nurses can do it, but I actually know how community health workers can do it.
Just one quick thing. And this is also the power of your network and your advocacy group, because if they feel like your voice has no power, they will discount you. Mm-hmm. So they dare not touch right now what was happening with docs and nurses and other professionals because of the political power and the advocacy. They must begin to respect you for your political power and your advocacy and your purchase power in the system. So that's a whole nother piece of it, but your voice. And the more they begin to see that you're at the table, you understand the local statistics of what it's costing them and what they will be penalized, plus your voice behind your voice. That is sort of the, because it's all tied back to the political power, too.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's 2 minutes to four. Is it a quick one?
Well, I just want to say that when you work with Latinos, maybe this community health worker is going to meet for today's or one day session to manage diabetes with a patient, but the cost effectiveness of having someone who can deliver the information and the training in Spanish and English, you have to count that as being so cost effective that it's worth
$50,000. That's right.
One question, and maybe just to leave everybody's mind.
Please.
I've been going through, you know, all the THW program here, and perhaps one of the things that I think there is a need and to develop perhaps is a THW business plan, sort of, you know, that, you know, we all been talking about little pieces of it, but putting it all together so that we can pull from the plan, you know, so that if you're working with researchers or you're working with whatever we've been said, that it could become something that, and it could be developed with the THW. But it could have a few components related to cost effectiveness. You know, there's going to be a presentation tomorrow. The person who's going to present it was sitting in one of the round tables, but he says he's comparing diabetic medication, the cost, and with the model of CHW, you know? And I thought that was very interesting because sometimes that's how, you know, they would think of buying medicines, you know, versus, so there's all this unique nuances that, I don't know, putting it all together.
And I, Matilde, thank you very much. I think that's a wonderful way to end the session, is let's really begin to think about how that we can collectively, we all bring something different to the table, something different to the conversation. And it's really important to think about how we can strengthen what we bring and work collectively to assist CHWs as they take the lead in the workforce development and as we move forward. I'd like to really thank the presenters. And just very quickly, Gail Hirsch did walk into the room, and I wanted to thank her so much for the work that she put in to make sure that this session happened. Thank you all, and I hope to see many of you at the CHW business meeting this evening.